who has been assigned to meet with the students for that day. While I say that to you, is there anyone here who would like a summary of the case? We have a summary similar to the ones that the students got. If you'd raise your right hand, okay, you don't get a summary then. The subject for the noon meeting with the justice is the procedure of the court in taking cases, hearing cases, and deciding cases. It is not a discussion of the substantive issues of the case. Everyone is invited to attend, not merely the students, but anybody here or who is otherwise listening to this discussion. So we've met you, and I'd like to introduce the court to all of you. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. The immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. You will meet with him after the second argument. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Seated next to Justice Crooks is Justice Patience Robinsack. And at the far left of the bench is Justice Michael Gableman. On the far right of the bench is Justice Annette Ziegler. And seated next to her is Justice Dave Prosser. See, that was pretty good. All mixed up that way, not in order. So with those introductions, I'll say one other thing. This is the first Wednesday of the month. And on the first Wednesday of the month at 11 o'clock, they test the fire alarm system. So if we're still here at 11 on this case, the alarm will go off. It's usually very noisy. You'll just stop speaking for the few moments that it takes. Sometimes it's a little longer, sometimes shorter. If you're not here and you hear it when you're in the building, it is a fire alarm testing. You need not leave the building. All right. So let me call the first case. That is 2013 AP 500, Melissa Anderson versus Tom. How is that pronounced? Powell. And arguing on behalf of the Wisconsin Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company is attorney Claude J. Cavelli. Counsel?
May it please the court, good morning. I represent Wisconsin Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company, known as WILMIC. WILMIC was formed in 1986 as part of the State Bar Initiative to deal with the high cost and limited availability of legal malpractice insurance in Wisconsin. WILMIC is a mutual company formed by Wisconsin attorneys to insure Wisconsin attorneys. The facts in this case are undisputed. WILMIC issued a policy to Mr. All's law firm. It was a claims made and reported policy for the policy period of April 1, 2009 to April 1, 2010. The insuring agreement stated, this insurance applies to claims first made against you, in this case Mr. All, and first reported to us in writing during the policy period. This was set forth on the declarations page. It was set forth in an important notice on the front. It is part of the insuring agreement, and it was even in the application for the policy. The policy unambiguously granted coverage for claims first made against all and first reported to WILMIC during the policy period. There's no argument in this case that the policy was ambiguous. The question is one of whether the statutes require that we provide coverage that the policy didn't provide.
Is the statute ambiguous?
Pardon me?
Is the statute ambiguous?
The statute is not ambiguous, Your Honor. The statute applies to claims made in reported policies. The statute talks about invalidating coverage provided by a policy, and it allows it to be invalidated if there is prejudice. The term is not defined. Our position is that what constitutes prejudice under an occurrence policy is different from what constitutes prejudice under a claims made and reported policy. In other words, prejudice is a very broad term. This court has articulated a standard for prejudice for occurrence policies, and we don't take issue with that standard as applied to occurrence policies. Our position is that these two types of coverage are fundamentally different.
Now, just to lay some groundwork, can you have a claims-made policy without a report within the same year policy? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes,
so
you can.
Are there such policies in Wisconsin?
You know, there are very few. Across the nation, claims made and reported policies have become the standard, not only in Wisconsin, but throughout the United States.
But you could have just a claims made policy.
You could have a claims made policy that then had a liability provision precedent requiring notice within a certain time.
Before or after. Yeah.
Yes. So the question is whether or not either of these statutes mandates any particular type of coverage. And my argument is no. Wilmick's argument is no. It talks in both statutes, both in 631-86 and 632-26, it talks about invalidating coverage. It doesn't create coverage. It doesn't require any particular coverage. What it talks about is invalidate the circumstances when a coverage promised and bought and paid for can be invalidated. And the statute says it can be invalidated only if the insurer is prejudiced by that lack of notice.
And what's the prejudice that you're claiming? It's not the same prejudice of the occurrence policy because it's not that you didn't have opportunity to investigate, et cetera.
Right, Your Honor. In other words, with an occurrence policy, the insurer said if the act or error or omission occurs during the policy period, we will provide you coverage regardless of when that claim might be made or regardless of when we get notice of it. So the insured has paid a premium to get that coverage. If they breach the condition in the policy, the notice condition, they're forfeiting. They're invalidating a coverage they bought and paid for. And I'm saying in that circumstance, the occurrence insurer can't say, well, we're prejudiced because we have to provide coverage. Because the answer is, well, you were paid to provide that coverage and you promised to provide that coverage. You have to show prejudice, something more, because you promised to provide this coverage. So prejudice there requires that the ability of the insurer to provide the promised coverage be impaired by the lack of notice. And we think that's totally appropriate for occurrence coverage. The distinction is claims made and reported coverage never offered or promised coverage for a claim that was made before or after the policy period or that was reported before or after the policy period. So the insurer didn't pay a premium for that coverage. In other words, the whole purpose of claims made and reported coverage is to take a smaller slice of the risk.
That just brings me to another question. I'm sorry, but I've got to get the groundwork done in my head. Which kind of policy has the long tail?
The occurrence policy has a long tail, particularly for legal malpractice insurance.
Or medical malpractice.
Pardon me?
Or medical malpractice.
Anything where there is, or even really sometimes products liability, although it's not as significant, but in particular for a lawyer. A lawyer, under an occurrence policy, makes an act or error or omission in 1 year, and the claim might not be made for decades. And the problem, and that's why occurrence insurance just didn't work for legal malpractice. Insurers said, well, I don't know when this risk is ever going to end. It could be 10, 20 years from now. They didn't know how to insure it. The most insurers said, hey, we don't want to touch it. Those that would charged a premium that was very high because of the risk. So the whole purpose of claims made and reported coverage was to take a smaller piece. Now, it doesn't create any gaps in coverage, and it covers the same risk as long as you keep the coverage. And you, when you retire, you can buy a tail to extend that coverage for some period of time for a separate premium if a claim is made later based on that. So it isn't a problem. Nobody's saying this is bad coverage or that this doesn't do the job or that insurance companies are abusing this form of coverage or that this form of coverage has created problems that this court has seen. The coverage has worked, and it's worked not only in Wisconsin, it's worked everywhere, and its sole purpose is to make insurance affordable and to have as many companies willing to provide that insurance so that competition will deal with it in the state of Wisconsin.
Yes. Can I ask a question? The policy in this case, as I understand it, was from April 1st, 2009 to April 1st, 2010, is that right?
Correct.
Pretty much. Hypothetically, suppose the insured gets notice of claim on March 25th, 2010, so that there are only a few days to report within the policy period. And let's say within 2 weeks there is a report of a claim. What happens under your interpretation?
Well, I would analogize it to an occurrence policy where the accident occurs a day after the policy ends. All right? They had insurance for 6 months or a year up through December 23. The accident happens the day after that occurrence policy expired. It is a contract. You have to draw a line somewhere. They would not have coverage under that occurrence policy, and nobody would say, well, gee, you know, it was only a day away. They should get coverage, even though it's not within the policy period. That's the same situation here. Now, that's not, of course, the case that's now before the court. The case that's now before the court involved a notice of claim that was received on December 23, of 1 year, and they had a full 3 months before the end of the policy term, April 1 of the following year, to report that claim. In this case, they even got a renewal application that specifically solicited, do you have any unreported claims? And they did not report it. So I think this court should not take on the hypothetical. It should deal with the interpretation of the statute of the actual case before it. When you get to this narrow window that you're talking about, Justice Prosser, I think that there could be an exception to the general rule. I don't know. I don't know whether the insurance company would stand on the limitation in that circumstance. But I would say that the contract is unambiguous and clear, and these two statutes don't deal with that subject. They deal with when do you invalidate coverage, and
okay,
it's not granted here.
Let me ask this. I was very interested when you mentioned 1986 for the Wilmack.
Right.
It's my understanding that both of the statutes in this case existed before then.
No question about it. They existed since 1979. I think, and I tried to lay that out in the brief, basically the ideology, if you will, of these statutes was that the rule under the contract law before the statutes were enacted was that if you breached the condition precedent, you had no coverage, irregardless of whether the insurer was or was not prejudiced. That was applied to an automobile policy, and shortly thereafter, the legislature said, well, whoa, wait a minute. That's pretty harsh because you've been promised coverage. The coverage was there. It was paid for. And now, because they're late notice, you're going to take that coverage away. And we're going to require prejudice. So from 1931, when that statute was passed, until 1979, that rule that you had to have prejudice only applied to motor vehicle policies. And motor vehicle policies are and always have been occurrence policies. And it was to deal with the fact that you're forfeiting, invalidating coverage, and that's what the statute was intended to do. Now, in 1979, the legislature moved this from the motor vehicle statute into 632.26, which applied to all liability policies. And the total statement in the history of it was, we think this is good. They really didn't explain any analysis as to why they should apply it to all these other policies or not. I don't think the legislature had claims made and reported policy in mind when they initially passed these statutes.
Were there any claims made and reported policies in Wisconsin in the 70s or 80s? I mean, you're only talking about Wilmack, but there must be claims made policies.
We're not arguing that the statute doesn't apply to claims made policies. It clearly does. I'm just saying I think that it came up in the context of an occurrence policy, a motor vehicle policy. That's how it started. That's how it sat from 1931 to 1979, and then they expanded it to all in 1979. So it definitely does apply.
Can you give me your best argument for why your argument is consistent with the language of the statute?
Yes. Number one. The statute addresses when an insurer can invalidate coverage. A coverage cannot be invalidated unless it has first been granted by the policy. So this is not a statute. These statutes do not require any particular type of coverage. They only deal with the circumstances when a coverage paid for and promised can be invalidated. And it says, it can be invalidated if there is prejudice. And my argument is requiring an insurer to pay a claim or to cover a claim it did not promise to cover, it was not paid to cover, is prejudice. It's the definition of prejudice. I can't think of anything more prejudicial to an insurance company than having to pay a claim they never agreed to pay, and they weren't paid a premium for. So prejudice is not a defined term in these statutes. Prejudice in the dictionary means an injury to one's interests or rights. I just can't see, nobody can claim requiring an insurance company to pay a claim it doesn't cover and it didn't get paid to cover isn't prejudice. The question is, has the court's prior interpretation that arose for occurrence policies, does that govern a claims made and reported policy? Or is there a distinction?
Interpretation of the word prejudice
is the key.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you mean by interpretation here. You know, I found your argument very persuasive when I read your brief. And then, of course, I read the other side, you know, and then you have troubles, you know, and then the judge reads it and says, oh, the first one's terrific. Now, and then you read the second one, and then you say to yourself, oh, that's terrific, too, and how do you make the decision? So I'm calling your attention to page 15 of the blue brief. This is your opposition. And it's the first.
Blue.
Yeah, blue. That's, you've got
not
that.
Green. Blue.
No, not the. The green is the amicus brief.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The blue brief, which is the Q and Quarles and Brady brief. Page 15. And this is what got me. And they give you a hypothetical that removes the notice from the conditions sections and puts it into the coverage section, like your policy, like your clients. It says, now they're going to write this occurrence policy as follows. We will indemnify the insured for bodily injury or property damage. That's standard language, right? Caused by an occurrence. And then they add the language, which the insured reports as soon as practical. So it becomes a coverage issue. If you don't do it as soon as practical, I mean, those are fighting words, right? But then you're into coverage rather than into some condition in the policy. So can we write, can somebody write that kind of policy and get into the same niche that you want to get into for your claims and report?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I know of no CGL policy that has.
No, but I mean, I'm going to start a new company. I'm going to
but let me
write this one.
I think what their allegation here is that Wilmick is trying to take one thing and slip it into another slot so that they can get what the statute prohibits. And my position is no, that is absolutely not the case, because claims made and reported, well, occurrence policies were not working for legal malpractice. They were too expensive and nobody wanted to write them. So the whole purpose of claims made and reported coverage was to find a way to make that coverage affordable. And to make it affordable, they limited the scope of the coverage so that the insured was not paying for coverage for claims that were made after the policy or before the policy period, or that were reported before or after the policy period. And it's a complicated situation as to how that affects the cost, but most of these insurers have reinsurers, and the ability to say, okay, this year is over, this is how much we've paid for you to reinsure us, and you don't have to worry about any more claims coming in next year or the next year or the next year, and that company then, that reinsurer, knows how much premium or how much they should charge to provide that coverage that they're providing for reinsurance. So the whole purpose of claims made and reported coverage is to reduce the premium so that the insurer doesn't in the first place pay for coverage that is reported after the claim period. Now, their argument is, well, but occurrence policy has this condition precedent. But, you know, when you're writing the insurance policy, the occurrence policy, you've got to charge a premium to cover it because you don't know that the insured is going to invalidate that coverage by failing to give notice. So they charge a premium for that coverage. And then if the insured breaches the condition precedent and it impairs the ability of the insurer to defend the claim, they lose that coverage that they paid for. And that was
Mr.
promised
Chiavelli,
to them.
Let me interrupt you at this point. One of the things that gave me some concern was that Judge Dreyfus, who was the trial judge, in ruling in favor of Wilmack and granting summary judgment, did not address the issue of prejudice. When I look at section 3226.2, I find some interesting language, and I'm wondering whether you think this is all relevant or not to the issue. The very end of 632.26.2 says, but the risk of non-persuasion is upon the person claiming there was no prejudice. Does that enter into this at all?
Your Honor, I don't think so, because I think the prejudice is so obvious here that requiring, if you don't pay a premium, and if the policy never promised in the first instance to provide coverage for a claim that's reported outside the policy period, requiring the insurer to provide that coverage is prejudicial. It is by definition prejudicial. This court has stated. Pardon me?
Don't you think that language about the person bearing the risk of non-persuasion, doesn't that seem to add to your argument?
You know, it could, but I think the fundamental issue here is this narrow, this subset of prejudice that has been applied to occurrence policies, should that be applied to claims made in reported policies, or is the fact that these coverages are fundamentally different and the purpose of notice is fundamentally different, distinguish the two? And why? This court is certainly not constrained to say the standard applicable to occurrence policies applies to any kind of policy. This court says prejudice, the word prejudice, and it looks at what does prejudice require? And it requires one thing for an occurrence policy, because that was coverage promised and paid for that would be forfeited, as opposed to claims made in reported coverage for which coverage was never promised and was never paid for. So you would be creating coverage. The statute would not be dealing with the circumstance to forfeit coverage. It would be creating coverage, and neither statute does that.
Counselor, if I buy your argument, it seems to me that it can never apply to claims-made policies. Tell me when it would apply to claims-made policies when the claim was not given in the policy period.
Well, it would. The statutes would never. There would always be prejudice. You're right.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you. I mean, you were initially asked by the Chief Justice, does the statute apply to both claims made and occurrence? And you said yes.
Yes, it
okay.
does.
Right. But it never does.
Yes, it does.
There's always prejudice under your theory. So if there's always prejudice, the statute never applies.
Well, the statute always applies. It applies to determine whether there's prejudice. There's always prejudice.
No.
So the statute applies. It just doesn't cover this circumstance. So
arguing that as a matter of law there's prejudice here because the statute increases your coverage, and that's not what your policy says.
And it's not, I don't, and we believe it's not what the statute says. The statute doesn't say you have to provide coverage that was never promised. It says you can't invalidate promised coverage without prejudice.
Counsel,
Ms. Bradman.
Thank you. In the green brief, that is the amicus brief, on page 6, they say, ha ha, what you are doing, Wilnick, is you are writing in words to the statute, something that should be an anathema, right? And it says in 632.26.1, you are saying, the statute provides, every liability insurance policy, and then you are writing in, they say, the words, except those issued on a claims made and reported basis.
We're not doing that. We're saying any liability policy include. We're not saying that statutes don't apply to claims made and reported policies or to Wilmick. They do.
But
we're saying that prejudice, the nature of the prejudice is different. In other words, we're distinguishing occurrence type prejudice from claims made and reported prejudice. And if you say we can't do that, you're basically saying these statutes prohibits claims made and reported coverage. And it doesn't. They don't. They don't address that issue.
See, I think that you kind of missed what Justice Crooks was trying to talk to you about, which was the statute that puts the burden on the insured to show there was no prejudice, which means they have to prove a negative. Instead, you've picked up the burden and placed it on your own shoulders, trying to get us to agree there's always prejudice. And when you get to the always prejudice, you always fall outside the statute. Right?
I tried to explain, we don't fall outside the statute. There is always prejudice to the claims made and reported insurer if it is required to provide coverage that the insured did not pay for and was not promised to have.
So you're right in the statute.
Pardon me?
So you are in the statute. You just don't fall within all the provisions of the statute.
Well, we meet the prejudice the, okay. requirement is
that's,
the way I would say it.
That's another way to say it, yes.
I see my red lights.
Justice Prosser.
I asked you a question before about claims made during the policy. I want to make sure I understand this. Your position is that if there's a policy from April 1st of 1 year to April 1st the next year, and you get the claim on March 31st, if you don't report it to the insurer by April 1st, the next day, you lose your coverage.
That would be the strict interpretation of that analysis, yes. Now, whether, if presented with that hypothetical, this court would find some exception to the general rule, that's not before us now. The question before us now is, is there prejudice? For example, is there prejudice to an occurrence insurer if they are required to cover an accident that happened the day after their policy period ended? I don't think anybody on this court would say, no, that's not prejudicial. Well, of course it's prejudicial. It's not within the scope of the coverage. And that's what we're saying here. To be within the scope of the coverage, the claim has to be both made against the policyholder and reported to Wilmick during the policy period. Now, it doesn't have to be reported by the insured. You know, every claimant, attorney, first thing they do when they write the lawyer is they say, who's your insurance company, and put them on notice. So the Andersons could have reported to Wilmick within those 3 months. Anybody could have reported it to Wilmick, but nobody did for 14 months.
Can you just discuss with me briefly, as a practical matter, how it works when you have claims made, insurance? I mean, it can't be that on April 1st they would call up and say, okay, now we need to negotiate a new claims made policy.
All right. In claims made and reported policies expressly state they are not renewable. All right? So every policy is separate. So prior to the end of a policy period, a renewal application is sent to the insurer. Wilmick's renewal application specifically solicits any unreported claims that may have existed under the prior policy as a part of the application for the next policy. In this case, the insured wrote down there are no unreported claims, even though since December of 2009 he's had this claim. So
under Justice Prosser's scenario, there'd probably be another policy that very next day that would already be in place. The insured wouldn't be wrong if when he negotiated that, he didn't list any claims because the claim arose on the day before the new policy began.
No.
So if it weren't covered on the previous one, it'd be covered on the next one. Is that
no,
what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. The claim has to be made and reported in the same policy period. It has to be made and reported under the same policy. So because the claim was first...
I understand what you're saying, but you're not following what I'm saying.
I guess I'm not.
Okay, fair enough. Your time's up anyway.
Thank you. I'll think about it.
Counsel? Jeffrey Davis of Quarles and Brady, representing the Andersons.
Yes, Chief Justice Abramson, and thank you. May it please the court. Good morning. I am Jeff Davis. I'm here with Pat Nolan, my partner from Quarles and Brady. Also appearing for the Andersons is Holly Stropp, who's in court, and Mrs. Anderson is also in court this morning. The court has before it a discrete issue, and that is, does an insured under a claims made and reported policy who receives a claim in the policy period but fails to timely provide notice of that claim automatically lose coverage? And for my clients, the Andersons, the answer to that question will likely determine whether there will be a source of recovery for their claim against Attorney Tom All. Now, I want to say at the outset that this is not a debate about claims made versus occurrence policies. All policies, claims made and occurrence policies, require the timely reporting of any, if it's an occurrence, the timely reporting of an occurrence. If it's claims made, the timely reporting of a claim. The fundamental difference between claims made and occurrence policies is the risk that the insurer underwrites. And with an occurrence policy, It's, as that name implies, an occurrence, an event causing injury. With the claims made policy, it is the claim. And I think there needs to be a distinction here between those risks that actually drive the coverage under those policies and the giving of notice.
Counsel, you refer to claims made, which resonates as a familiar term. But here we're talking about claims made and reported, and you fail to use that additional language. Why?
The reason is, Justice Bradley, is because I think the crisis, the malpractice crisis that counsel has alluded to in 1986, had to do with the fact that occurrence policies were, frankly, providing too long of a tail with respect to insurance companies' willingness to underwrite that risk. Claims made policies shorten that tail, and that has nothing to do with whether or not the claim is reported in the policy period. The claim, there is a finite period in which the claim against the party must be made, and that is within the policy period, as opposed to an injury that could give rise to a claim many years later.
Help me with this, if you will. The insurance policy is a contract, and a contract can say not just claims made, but and claims reported.
It can. And this is not a question about interpreting that contract. We all agree that that's what this contract says. It's not even a question about this court deciding as a matter of public policy whether to engraft some exception to the reporting requirement for a failure to abide by that provision in the policy. What this case is about is the interpretation of two statutes that the legislature has seen fit to govern this very issue.
Are you suggesting the claim was made and reported within the policy period?
That's what a claims made and reported policy requires.
Okay. When was this claim made and when was this claim reported?
This claim was made in December of 2009 and was at the point at which a letter was received by Tom All, the attorney in this case, demanding the unwinding of a transaction in which he had been involved, as well as my clients. And the claim was, at that point, Mr. All did not report that claim. The claim was reported in March 2011.
Okay, and when was the policy period?
The policy period was April 1, 2009 to April 1 of 2010.
So your answer to my question was you are saying it was both made and reported within the policy period.
It was not.
Okay.
The claim was made in the 2009-2010 period and reported in the 2010-2011 period.
If it had been reported in January 2009, the policy would be covered. You wouldn't be here because you would get the money under the policy.
That is correct.
And the reason you're here is because it wasn't reported, and because it wasn't reported, Wilmax says we're not paying because tortfeasor, which is the lawyer, I mean, you represent the, quote, innocent victim. The tortfeasor who's the lawyer, I assume that, right?
Correct.
The tortfeasor didn't report it within the policy period, and the fact that they may have bought another policy that covered 2010 through 2011 doesn't help you, so Wilmax says, because that only covers claims made and the same claim is reported in that policy period, and this claim was made in the prior policy.
That's correct.
That's a correct statement of what the case is about.
The only thing I'll add to that is that the subsequent policy period, the 2010-2011 period, and I think this is important, Wilmax has denied coverage under that policy because of an alleged failure to report for purposes of its application on that policy.
That's another issue, too.
They're seeking rescission, which is not before the court, but I think demonstrates that, frankly, is the way in which the law addresses failures to report under a claims made and reported policy.
If I can go back to what I was just sort of setting this up to, get the basics. Obviously, that's what the case is about. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here because they would have paid the claim. So having said that, what in the statute saves you, and how isn't that basically undoing every claims-made policy? I mean, sometimes I think your argument is turning a claims-made policy into an occurrence policy. So how does a claims-made policy survive under the argument you're making?
Well, I'm certainly not trying to convert a claims-made policy into an occurrence policy. And to use, frankly, I'll use Mr. Covelli's analogy when he said that it was, you know, the failure to report on the last day, you know, in which a claim is made, if you don't report it until after, that's like saying that there's an accident after the policy under an occurrence policy. The better analogy would be to say if the claim was made after the expiration of a policy. There's no question here that the claim was made within the policy period, and that's the triggering event.
The problem you have with that, though, is it's a claims made and reported
right.
policy, so you have to help me over that.
The claim is actually the claim, we agree. I do not disagree that the claim must be made within the policy period for there to be coverage. If it's made after the policy period, it's typically going to be covered in the renewal policy. But the claim has to be made. The question is, does that notice, does that reporting also have to be made within the policy period if there's no prejudice to the insurer by the failure to report? And I think those are two fundamentally different things. And
how do you get coverage? How do you get coverage in the first instance if it wasn't reported?
Because of these statutes. And I want to talk
about your best argument on the language of the statute.
Right. And I want to talk about that because Mr. Covelli has placed a lot of emphasis on language that he says is in these statutes. There are two of them. 631.81 is one of them. It was passed in 1976. And that statute states, in pertinent part, that failure to furnish such notice or proof within the time required by the policy does not invalidate or reduce a claim unless the insurer is prejudiced thereby. Now, Mr. Covelli has, and the statute actually talks a little bit about providing notice of loss as soon as reasonably possible. But Mr. Covelli has focused on the word invalidate and said there must be coverage in the first instance, or a coverage part that's invalidated before you ever get to this statute. And in fact, the problem with that is the second statute, 632.26, which was passed 3 years later in 1979. And 632.26 eliminates any peculiarities with respect to this as soon as reasonably required language. It also does not use the word invalidate with respect to the prejudice requirement. It's much broader. It states that failure to give notice as required by the policy, and it doesn't say by any condition or coverage grant or anything else, failure to give notice as required by the policy does not bar liability under the policy if the insurer was not prejudiced by the failure.
So then you would say that 631.81 really makes a claims-made policy contingent upon two things. One, the claim has to be within that policy period, but the reporting part of the claim, you have a year after that policy period to make that claim unless there's prejudice.
Well, 631.81, as I indicated, has this as soon as reasonably possible proviso. Frankly, that in the courts up to this date have not really focused on that language, including in the case that came out shortly after these statutes, Girard Realty, or actually after the 631.81, where the court simply said that prejudice is a requirement with respect to the forfeiture of coverage for late notice.
Also, I want to interrupt you just a minute because I tried to get this discussion started earlier with Mr. Covelli and was not successful. I'm very interested in 632.26.2 because it says the risk of non-persuasion is upon the person claiming there was no prejudice. And the trial court didn't deal with prejudice. And as an old trial lawyer, prejudice was always a fact question in my day. Now I know with uncontested facts you can make it a matter of law. But I didn't see any argument about how you proved on behalf of your client that Wilmot was not prejudiced. And I read the statute
as you're having that burden. Now, I may be wrong on how I read the statute, so you can correct me on that. But if I'm not, I want you to tell me, how did you prove that they had no prejudice?
Justin Rogensack, the statute, in fact, does refer to the risk of non-persuasion being on the person claiming no prejudice. And first of all, I would say that that language would suggest that, in fact, prejudice is a factual inquiry, and that's consistent with this Court's decisions. With respect to what happened at the trial court, let me back up for a second. Risk of non-persuasion does not necessarily mean the burden of going forward. In the legislative history, this statute says that. In fact, it says that the burden of going forward may well be should be placed on the insurer because the insurer may be in a better position to say whether or not they were prejudiced, as a matter of fact. And what happened here in the trial court was that Wilmoth filed a motion for summary judgment, did not argue any factual prejudice of the type that we normally think of. They didn't argue that they couldn't defend the claim. They didn't argue that they were not able to investigate, not able to interview witnesses. And, in fact, they would be hard-pressed to do so since the lawsuit on this claim actually didn't occur for another year after notice. Wilmoth made the argument it's making today. The Andersons essentially not only, filed a rebuttal to that argument, but also argued just what I've said, that they didn't make it. They didn't make any of those arguments.
Okay, so you're saying that what's underneath this, there is a burden of going forward, which isn't set forth in the statute.
It's not. And that was a deliberate decision by the legislature, at least according to the legislative history.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That helps to answer my question.
Have you completed your answer to Justice Ziegler? I'm sorry. You were interrupted.
I think I had, unless Justice Ziegler has other.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Davis, what do you think about the fact that Judge Dreyfus made no findings in regard to prejudice, but the Court of Appeals did? And as you indicated earlier, usually the determination of prejudice is an issue of fact. Was it appropriate for the Court of Appeals if it's... If we assume for a minute it usually is an issue of fact, to make that determination?
I think it was, Justice Crooks, and that is because certainly Wilmoth had the opportunity to make a showing of actual prejudice. And nothing would have prevented them from, positing the argument that they now posit today with respect to presumed prejudice or automatic prejudice, while at the same time, if there was any prejudice, to say, by the way, we also were not able to timely investigate the claim or interview these witnesses or that witnesses. As I indicated earlier, I don't mean to speculate, but I do think they would have been hard-pressed to make that type of showing.
I guess that I'm troubled because I'm troubled by the same language in the statute that Justice Rogensack is. And that seems to indicate that the risk of non-persuasion is upon the person claiming no prejudice. Now, that's your clients.
Correct.
If that risk is there, how did they meet that risk?
We argued in the trial court that there was no showing of actual prejudice, and there's a fairly lengthy passage and section of the trial court brief in which that argument was made, in which many of the same things that the Court of Appeals found in its analysis with respect to the lack of actual prejudice came from from the trial court brief. Now, was there an affidavit where there was an admission from the insurance company that they wouldn't have done anything different or anything like that? No, that did not. We don't have that type of record in this case. But I think as far as the risk of non-persuasion is concerned, it was a risk that was under, it was a burden that was undertaken by the Andersons in the trial court below.
You indicate the legislative history specifically references that the burden of going forward on the issue of prejudice would be placed on the insurer. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that what the legislative history says is that we specifically are not addressing that issue, but it may well be more appropriate to put the risk of burden of the burden of going forward on the insurer, since they're in the better position of having access to evidence and things of that nature going to prejudice. And frankly, that statement alone, I think, indicates what the legislature had in mind with respect to the type of inquiry that would be appropriate under these statutes.
Mr. Davis, cases that come to this court tend to involve or tend to impact far more than the parties. And I get the suggestion here from opposing counsel that if the Andersons win this case, it's going to affect the cost of insurance for every attorney in the state. What's your response to that?
I don't think it will. And the reason that I don't think it will is because this is not going to do away with claims-made policies. In a prejudice inquiry, you ask, what would the insurance company have done different if notice had been given earlier in this, in a particular case? And if notice had been given in December of 2009 of this demand letter, it would not have affected the premium or the pricing of the policy under which that we're here on. And that's because the policy had already been written. What it might have affected is the policy in the subsequent year, the renewal policy, and in fact, it might have given rise to a rescission claim, and in fact, a rescission claim has been made in this case. So I think it's a bit of a false construct to say that pricing is going to be significantly impacted by saying that in a claims-made and reported policy, the insurer still must show prejudice, or prejudice still must be an issue, actual prejudice, before coverage would be forfeited.
If I hear you right, you said no, prices won't go up. But the real answer is it will, because when they write the second policy, they are really potentially insuring against something that happened in the first year of the policy, but then it hadn't been reported yet. And therefore, they'd have to charge more because they're taking on two risks. One, claims made in the second year, and two, claims made in the first year but not reported in the first year. So there's a drag on the premium, or there should be. Now, you know, insurance companies don't have, and liability policies don't have the same actuarial information and ability to predict as they do in life insurance, which they've done for hundreds of years and have it down fairly well. So I'm not sure what the premium will be, but theoretically it will go up.
Theoretically it perhaps could. But again, Your Honor, I think in the situation that you're describing, the unreported claim is not likely to be covered under the second policy.
Well, because they would say the truth on the application for the second policy, and therefore they could exclude that.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Now, you know, I'm sorry. You do. I really thought the essence of your argument was in your brief at page 13. And it really is an attack on all claims made and report policies. Because what it says, if I read it right, was you can have claims made policies. That's no problem. But you can't have what is attempted here, a claims made and reporting policy, because, and here's what you write, the reporting of such claims is not part of the risk that the carrier underwrites. You're saying they really can't do it, that the reporting is a condition, or as some cases have described it as a covenant, citing the Maryland, it's Maryland, is it, case, yes, which the insured must satisfy to receive coverage for the underwritten risk. Whether that condition is set forth in the part of the policy defining what's covered or in a separate section specifying conditions, and you say in Wilmack it was in both, is a distinction without a difference. In either case, the substance is exactly the same under the policy as written. Coverage for the risk that is covered depends on timely notice.
Correct.
So if we accept your position, the reporting aspect of this policy has nothing to do with coverage.
It is not the risk. It can't be.
Right.
And that's because under the fortuity principle that underlies all insurance, reporting a claim, giving a notice, is not something that an insurance company covers.
And the risk is that a claim will be made during that period. It was made here, therefore your client ought to get paid. I mean, that's your full argument.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I'm not saying that you can't, an insurer under a claims made or claims made and reported policy, they can still show prejudice, potentially, if the reporting condition is not met.
But they can't show prejudice, which I think is their argument here, by saying that the prejudice is a matter of law because the policy is now interpreted to cover more than the policy covered.
Correct.
That's their claim for prejudice. And you're saying that's not prejudice because you can't write that kind of policy. I mean, that's how I hear this.
So really the reporting part isn't a condition of coverage. The reporting part is a mushier concept that deals with prejudice.
Oh, it is a condition, as written, but it's a condition that is subject to the requirements of the statute. And if it wasn't for the statute, we'd be back into cases like RTE, which this court issued in 1976, saying that you blow the condition, you've blown coverage. I don't care if it's, in that case, it was within a few weeks after notice was required. It's the same thing. Coverage would not exist under these policies as written. And it's only because of the statute, which says that with notice, we're not going to let you go that far without a showing of prejudice. And I think on that point, it's important to point out some other legislative history that we have identified here.
Is the statute ambiguous? I mean, we don't usually look at legislative history unless it's ambiguous or unless it confirms what our interpretation is.
That's true. And I don't think it is ambiguous. But in the event that the court disagrees with me, I do think that it's worthwhile to note that what the legislature said, and this is under 1976, the 631.81, the legislative history said that insurers should compete on clearly formulated variations in insurance benefits, premiums, and a few other major clauses, and very little on details of an ancillary nature, such as the period for notice of loss or the appraisal procedure. So with the way the legislature viewed this was that notice was really something that it's an important policy condition, but not one in which the legislature thought it was important necessarily to allow insurers to kind of do whatever they wanted in the marketplace.
Counselor, I'm still interested in 632.26, and this time I want to talk to you a little bit about one subsection B, which says the failure to give any notice required by the policy within the time specified does not invalidate a claim made by the insured if the insured shows that it was not reasonably possible to give the notice within the prescribed time and that the notice was given as soon as reasonably possible. So what's your best argument that you can give me why the December letter that he got doesn't cause that provision to let Wilmack out of coverage?
I can't argue that. What I can argue is what the next provision says, that failure to give notice as required by the policy as modified by sub 1B does not bar liability under the policy if the insurer was not prejudiced by the failure.
Okay, so what you're saying is that your client is caught by sub B but let go by subsection 2.
I am, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Could I ask?
Just process.
I'm you may have answered this before. Is prejudice under an occurrence policy and prejudice under a claims made and reported policy identical?
I think they are. Under the statute does not make a distinction, and the statute applies to every liability policy. This court has defined what is prejudice, and I think under either case, almost as a matter of common sense, what prejudice means is that the insurer would have done something different if he had received earlier notice. A good example of that is the Fireman's Fund v. Bradley case decided by this court a few years ago, where the insurer admitted they would have done nothing different. And so this court found that there was no prejudice, despite the fact that the case had been pending for many years or for many months and was set to go to trial before too long. And with both respect to claims made and occurrence policies, I think that should be the inquiry. And it's a factual inquiry. What would the insurance company have done different? And if the answer is nothing, then the legislature has basically said that we don't think insurers should lose coverage under those circumstances. And
I can ask, in the Neff case, the court said prejudice to the insurer in this context is a serious impairment of the insurer's ability to investigate, evaluate, settle a claim, determine coverage, blah, 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 blah. Then it says whether an insurer has been prejudiced is governed by the facts and circumstances of each case.
Yes.
Is that a bouquet for the other side here?
Is that
a bouquet to Mr. Covelli?
No, I mean, I think in any case, it is a factual inquiry, and it is specific to any given situation. An insurer is going to have to show that there was suffering of actual prejudice in a particular case. And in this case, there was no showing of actual prejudice, as this court's defined it. There's nothing to show what Womack would have done different. All they have argued is that in every case, we should be deemed to be prejudiced because it rewrites our policy, essentially. I just want to sort of conclude by saying that, and I want to pick up something Justice Prosser said earlier, that this is a public policy determination that's going to have ramifications beyond this case. There are lots of claims-made policies in this state and elsewhere. They govern not only lawyers' malpractice, but also most employers' practice liability policies. For every employer in the state is typically written on this basis. Directors' and officers' liability policies are typically written on this basis. And, you know, there's an irony in Womack's position in this case, and the irony is this. These claims made and reported policies are notorious for causing hardship to insurers in particular situations and to cause what I would call a sort of a gotcha and cause insurers to lose coverage, sometimes through no fault of their own.
What I hear you say, though, is that a claims made and a claims made and reported policy are identical because the and reported part is the prejudice prong. And that would be the same in a claims made case, too, right?
Right. Well, a claims made policy is certainly going to require prompt notice, not necessarily by the end of the reporting period.
But if you didn't give prompt notice, you'd have that prejudice. I mean, they're identical.
Same with occurrence. They all require prompt notice. But with respect to these claims made and reported policies, you get in situations where, you know, you get a claim a couple of days before the policy period, and all of a sudden you've got to give notice right away. I see my time's up. Can I?
You may finish
that point?
The sentence.
Okay. I see when that occurs, you know, you basically have a forfeiture without any real harm or hardship to the insured, and I think that Dolan and Furtake case from Florida is a very good example. Our legislature has decided that is not the result that should occur in Wisconsin, and I would submit to the court that is a good thing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Covelli.
May it please the Court. Counsel, and Justice Rowan at this point, said that the invalidated language isn't part of 632.26(2), but it is referred to in sub 2, which refers back to sub 1B, which clearly says does not invalidate a claim. Both of these statutes talk about invalidating a claim that was covered and paid for. The premise of their argument is that these statutes somehow prohibit claims made and reported coverage. They do not. They do not require any particular type of liability coverage. They solely deal with the circumstances where promised and paid for coverage can be invalidated because of a failure of notice by the insured and requires prejudice. It doesn't define prejudice. Their argument is the prejudice is identical between an occurrence policy and a claims made policy. They're saying that the prejudice for an insurer who has been paid a premium under an occurrence policy to provide coverage, regardless of when the claim is made and when notice is given, and the forfeiture of that paid for coverage is exactly the same as coverage that was never promised in the first place and not paid for. The whole purpose of dividing this piece of the pie, this piece of the risk, in this smaller piece in claims made and reported coverage is to make that the premium affordable, more affordable, because it is a smaller piece and it's a more defined piece of the risk. So the very essence, the very reason this coverage exists.
Comment on your argument.
I was going to say I added that for emphasis. The bottom line here is do these statutes require or prohibit, really, claims made and reported coverage? And I say they don't. So that's the starting point. They have not identified any statute. Do you want me to wait, Your Honor?
It depends on how the court's feeling. I can hear
I'm
you
loud,
fine,
so.
But if you're bothered by it, I thought maybe we could get to finish before it started, but it was a wrong call on my part. So why don't you just wait a couple of minutes? It's interesting that
it's a little quieter in
ring
here.
It from the various auditory sounds outside the courtroom at the moment.
It doesn't bother me if well, there we go.
Well, if we talked long enough, I know we'd get through. Go ahead.
My point is the premise is that there's a statute out there that says claims made and reported coverage is not allowed by the Wisconsin statutes. And my point is neither of these statutes say that. They deal with one circumstance, and that is when can promised and paid for coverage be invalidated? It doesn't say it creates coverage that was never granted or paid for in the first instance. Therefore, I say prejudice is a broad term. It is any injury to the rights or interests of the insurer in this case. And to require the insurer to provide coverage for a claim that it never promised to cover and went out of its way to explain to the insured it is not covered by putting it in an important notice, by putting it in the declarations page, by putting it in the insuring agreement, by putting it in the application, and even putting in there that our prejudice is conclusive if you don't report the claim within the policy period, not to contractually make it conclusive, but to put the insured on notice. You got to report this during the policy period. And these are lawyers.
The statute trumps, doesn't it, any provision that might be contrary to a statute in a policy?
It does if it is in fact, and that's my point. This statute, these two statutes, don't say you can't have coverage defined, and it's clearly the coverage is in the insuring agreement. We cover claims made and reported during the policy period. That is not a condition of coverage. That is a coverage provision. The liability provision in an occurrence policy is a liability provision. It says, yeah, you had this coverage, but you're going to forfeit it if you don't give us this notice. And that's the key distinction. And I agree, Your Honor, if you interpret these two statutes to prohibit claims made in reported policies, then it's prohibited and we can't do it, even though it is the standard in the industry throughout the United States. It won't be in Wisconsin. And there's a reason it's the standard in the industry. It works. It's good. It's not created problems. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cavilli, and thank you, Mr. Davis, for your arguments, even with the fire alarm. The court will take these under advisement, and so concludes our hearing in 2013 AP 500, Melissa Anderson versus Thomas Owl. We will take a short break so the students who wish to leave may leave, and if there are other students come in, they may do that, and so we are in recess for a few moments.